I'd like to thank you for your attendance at the session 151 titled Mormons for Agency, Reproductive Revolution in the Mormon Context. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is a mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind while engaging in the question and answer portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine. 7 issues for the price of 6, also available at the registration desk. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session will be 90 minutes, and we ask both the audience and the presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to begin on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, we clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. We are going to do the question and answer a little bit differently due to the sensitivity of this session and the topic being discussed. We are going to have the question and answer done on note cards. If you need a pen, just kind of raise your hand. We have a very kind volunteer who is helping us out. And we will collect the note cards and make sure that they are appropriate questions and comments for this topic. Mormons for Agency is a new group that includes Mormons from all walks of life who research, discuss, or share their experience and information about LDS views and policies on topics such as reproductive rights, birth control, bodily autonomy, and abortion. M4A seeks an open and public discussion and advocates for the right of all people to exercise full agency over their own bodies and reproductive choices. This panel will include firsthand abortion stories by Mormon women, address Mormon views and LDS policies on these topics, and discuss how to get involved, share your story, or participate in this important discussion. Sammy Galvez is a queer immigrant, Latino activist, and community voice. With a BS degree in neuroscience and an abiding interest in public health, he works for healthcare access for everyone, especially communities in his native Guatemala. Emma Tuller Stone, a sophomore at Columbia University, studying English and creative writing. She is interning at Planned Parenthood and preparing for an editorship at Columbia's Daily Spectator and Quarto magazine. I have a degree in educational sciences and live in San Diego with my 4 children. I am a former foster parent and ran the support group for HIV-positive and drug-exposed children in foster care, and am active in the special needs parenting community. Crystal Young Otterstrom is the executive director of Utah Cultural Alliance and also manages a marketing PR and event production firm called Brand Pink. Crystal is actively involved in politics and chairs LDS Democrats and also sits on the C4 board of Planned Parenthood Association of Utah. Kara Galtney grew up in a Mormon household in Provo, Utah, with her single mother who immigrated from Venezuela. Kara left the church and now lives in Salt Lake City, has attended Salt Lake Community College, and has been working for Planned Parenthood since 2015. Maxine Hanks is an independent scholar who lectures and writes on gender studies in religion. She serves on the Utah Pro-Choice Coalition. She served on the Utah Pro-Choice Coalition from 1991 to 2003, participated in pro-choice rallies, and wrote articles about reproductive issues in LDS culture. Chelsea Hicken was raised in an LDS home by a mother who was an active leader holding both primary president and Relief Society president positions. She is a feminist and Democrat socialist and believes both of these align with the teachings of Christ. And Alexandra Sandvik is a recent graduate from the J. Reuben Clark Law School and has contributed legal and sociological research for amicus briefs to the United States Supreme Court regarding whole women's health versus Hellerstedt. Additionally, she has studied feminist legal theories and their impact on state and federal legislation concerning sexual well-being. We are going to open up with some first-person accounts. And again, we ask that everybody in the room remain sensitive to the personal and very sensitive nature of this topic.
I'll introduce myself real quickly. My name is Kara Galtney, and this is my story. So, it's the weekend before Christmas, and I'm standing in line at the pharmacy waiting to get my antibiotics and my painkillers. I'm with my mother at the time, and she leans over for about the fifth time to remind me, in her heavy Venezuelan accent, that we are not allowed to discuss this with anyone ever again. And I don't know if any of you guys have seen the show Modern Family, but my mother is Sofia Vergara's character, Gloria, to a T, except she's very LDS and also believes in black magic. So if anybody can put the fear of God in me, it is my mother. And that was one of those moments. As I'm standing in line and it's my turn to give my script to the pharmacist, it dawns on me that there's going to be four people in the entire world that will know that I just had an abortion. Myself, my mother, and the two pharmacists at Walmart who are going to fill my prescription, and I am completely humiliated. I go, give them my script, and I sit down in the lobby and I wait with my mother. Her and I aren't having a conversation, we're not trying to, so I just have some time to sit there and reflect about what got me to this point in my life. I was always considered a really good girl in Mormon standards growing up. I was really awkward, I had a back brace, and I wasn't very social at church or at school. I just lived through books and through music. That was kind of where I gained my perspective of the world. So you can imagine, as a tween, being sat down in a back brace and having your mother talk to you about sex is really mortifying. And not only that, she couldn't refer to sex as sex. She called it chaka chaka, which in English is translated into boom boom, I imagine. So I eventually kind of blossomed. I never really had any sexual education in school, and the only moment I had the sex talk was when my mom talked about chaka chaka. So I graduated high school, I blossomed a little bit, and I finally met this guy who was very striking, beautiful, charismatic, and we just hit it off. And it kind of felt like one of those movies where the hot popular guy notices that the introvert nerd is kind of cool and kind of cute, and we were completely infatuated with each other. I started my first semester of college after dating, and things quickly spiraled after that. He became very obsessive. I would leave class and I would have about 20 missed phone calls and a million different texts that ranged in so many different emotions. They went from, hey, why aren't you answering me? To, you must be sleeping with somebody right now. You are such a slut. To, babe, I love you so much. Just return my call. I want to be with you forever. And that was really hard for me because I felt like I had just started this new life and I had chaka chaka with him. And I was like, I need, in order to justify it and be Mormon, I just felt that we needed to work things out because we were planning on getting married. And one night, he just showed up at my doorstep. He didn't think I was at home studying, and I was, and he startled my family. And at that point, he crossed the line, and that was too much for me, and I decided that I was going to end things with him. I didn't want to do it in front of my family, so I left with him, and we were arguing in his car for a while, and when he realized that I was set and that I was done with him, he parked the car, and he just calmly asked me, so you're ending things with me. And at that moment, the energy just kind of shifted in the car, and I felt the hair on the back of my neck and arms stand up. And before I could finish saying yes, he backhanded me and broke my nose. And at that point, I don't really remember what happened next. I just remember driving around, and he was sobbing, asking me to forgive him, and I finally somehow made it home. And the next morning, there was no denying that my nose was broken. Underneath my eyes, it was completely gray, green, and yellow. My lip was busted, and my family knew exactly what happened, but I didn't give them any explanation. I didn't want to talk about it. So the next few days, again, multiple missed phone calls, didn't answer. And I was feeling sick, and I decided to scrounge up some change and just head to the grocery store to take a pregnancy test. I knew I wasn't pregnant. I just wanted that peace of mind. And, of course, I went to the store. I took the test in the restroom there, and I was pregnant. And I remember being completely devastated because I didn't know how my life got to that point. I did everything correct up until then, I felt like, and I was still in love with this guy who wasn't good for me. And I've always been an intelligent girl, and it was very conflicting to fight with those emotions. And on top of that, I was pregnant. So I decided that I wasn't going to deal with it. I couldn't. So I was going to let nature take its course. I was either going to have the baby or I was going to miscarry. I just didn't want to deal with it. And I walked home, and I threw away the test at the store and ripped up the receipt. So there was no evidence of that pregnancy test. The next couple days, I was laying in bed, and my mom came into the room, and she sat down next to me and started to hold my hand. And she just looked at me and said, "Kara, I know that you're pregnant. You are my daughter. I love you, and I hurt when you hurt, and I know that you're pregnant." And at that point, my world just completely was upside down because I destroyed every shred of evidence of the pregnancy test, and yet my mother knew. I hadn't told anyone. And so at that moment, I got really frustrated, and I just stormed out of the house. And she was begging me not to go because she knew I was going to meet up with my ex-boyfriend, which I did. I called him because I felt, since my mom knew, I needed to tell him as well. So we met just a few blocks away from my house, and when I told him that I was pregnant, he punched me in the stomach and said that he didn't want to have my baby anyway. So he left, and I kind of just gathered my emotions, and I tried to keep calm, and I walked home. And before I walked in my door, I just kind of brushed the tears aside and put on a brave face, and I walked through the door, and my mother was sitting there waiting for me in the living room. And I just remember that the tears just came. I couldn't keep them back any longer. And she stood up and gave me a hug, which is weird for her because she's not a hugger. So when she hugs you, you know that it's a good thing. And I knew that I was going to be safe, and I didn't have to say anything. We just scheduled my abortion procedure, and the clinic staff was amazing. They made me feel human for the first time in a really long time. And thanks to my mother, who gave me a voice when I feel like I didn't have one, I had my abortion, and I no longer have any ties to this man. Thank you.
My story is slightly doesn't follow the usual pattern of an abortion story because I have a 6-year-old daughter who is from it. But I was pregnant and very, very sick from a pregnancy with who would become my second child in late 2009, early 2010. And from the beginning of my pregnancy, I ran a half marathon, and I didn't know I was pregnant and was having a very, very difficult time recovering from this half marathon, and I was having a lot of heart issues, and I went into the cardiologist and was like, "I don't know what's happening. I can barely walk up a flight of stairs. I can't stay awake. I'm vomiting constantly. Like, I don't know what the problem is." And they did an echo, and they said that I had a heart condition. And they said, "But the real problem is here is that you are 4 weeks pregnant." And came as quite a shock. And so as I dealt with that, I progressively became more and more sick until I was throwing up approximately 40 to 60 times a day. And around Christmas, when I was about 15 weeks along, I went into kidney and liver failure and went into the hospital thinking like it was appendicitis or something like that. And they came back in and said that I was so violently dehydrated from throwing up so much that my organs were shutting down and that there were a few options that we could consider, but we should probably start looking at whether or not abortion was an option for this pregnancy. And at the time, I was a faithful, married in the temple, wear my garments, pay my tithing, teach Relief Society, Mormon. And I wanted to make sure that I had tried everything I possibly could. And so I had a PICC line placed, and I hung up IV bags of fluid every night on my bed, and I injected my vitamins into this, and I took IV medication every 4 hours, and I slowly saw a light at the end of the tunnel. I, at this time, had a 2-year-old son and would feed him by putting piles of Cheerios on the floor because that was the only energy that I had until we realized that was not sustainable and he went to daycare. I was slowly, slowly becoming somebody who could get out of bed and who could shower when at 19 weeks my water broke. And I went into the hospital, and they said, there's nothing we can do. We'll just wait and see what happens. And so we waited. And life kept on going, and I would have my regular checkups, and they would say, well, it looks like everything's okay. Who knows what's going to happen? You could easily go to 40 weeks. And I was out one evening. My husband had been gone for 4 weeks doing an away rotation for medical school, and he had just come home and driven through a blizzard to come home, and we were grabbing dinner when I knew that I needed to go to the hospital. And I went to the hospital, and they said, there's really nothing we can do for you because you are 23 weeks along, and that's before viability. So we can deliver this baby in what we call an abortion of pregnancy, and we can attempt to resuscitate, but she's not going to survive. And that's what we decided to do. We knew that I would not live if we continued the pregnancy, and we knew that she likely would not live if we ended it. And sitting there in that hospital room, knowing that I was choosing my life over this unborn child that we felt so connected to, was at that point the hardest decision I have ever made. And to this day, my medical record lists her delivery as a medical abortion, as a termination of pregnancy, because she was not supposed to survive. She has never read a medical file and doesn't know that. So she is now a 6-year-old kid who falls asleep every night on a ventilator and is fed through a feeding pump and thinks that she's a princess because she doesn't know she's supposed to be a feminist either. But it is because I knew that I had that choice that she lived, because if I had fought to make it to viability, none of us, neither one of us, would have survived. And that is why those moments of choice are so important at every juncture that we have.
Hi, everyone. I'm Chelsea. I've previously told this story as one of finding my voice. And today I want to share with you how it also was the story of accepting myself and who I could be. For a long time, I lived torn between two selves. Before I was 7, I was raised by a single mom who taught me that family was the most important thing, that service brought joy, and that hard work and determination could get you anywhere and anything. When I was 7, she got married to a man in the temple, and we started going to church, and then I was taught that temple marriage, obedience to your husband, and magnifying your church callings was the only path to God. When I was 18, I moved out with a boy, and I was reminded that that was a sin, and if I chose to live that life, I would no longer be part of the family. So I married him, because family is the most important thing. He wanted to have children. I wasn't ready, but I was obedient to my husband. By 25, I had been divorced twice and had 2 children. I didn't know who I was or who I could be, and I didn't believe that I had any value or self-worth. I put my children into a safe place, and I left, and I was gone for a very long time. I traveled the country. I tried to be a good person. I served others. But eventually, I came home to Utah. I was determined this time to find the one. My patriarchal blessing had told me I would not err in choosing my eternal companion, so I knew that I could do it. I was repairing my relationship with my sons, and I met him. I met the perfect guy. He was nerdy and cute and fun, and I fell madly in love with him. We talked about the future. We talked about families. We talked about what that meant for each of us. We talked about birth control, and he knew that I was not on it. About a year into our relationship, I became pregnant. When I planned to tell him, I was sure that it would be a little scary. It was a little different. We hadn't really talked about doing it right away, and but we would get through it. We would get through it together because we loved each other. And he turned to me and said, "I suppose abortion is off the table." And my whole world ended. I didn't know up from down. I didn't know how I was going to survive. For 2 weeks, we went back and forth. I fought with my conscience. Is abortion murder? Can I raise a child on my own? What will my children think if I keep this one and be a mother to this one when I didn't stay a mother to them? In the end, I chose an abortion. I chose to do that because I knew in my heart that it was the only way I was going to be able to truly become myself. That abortion became the catalyst for me finding out that I am not somebody who has to be obedient, but that I can have a voice. I am somebody who can stand up for women's rights. I can be a champion of choice, and I have not for one moment ever wished that I had not made that decision. Because of that, I have become a voice for reproductive justice And I've become a true and good mother to my children, and I have truly found myself. Thanks.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Emma, and you already heard a brief introduction of me, but most importantly today, I am a board member of Mormons for Agency. First and foremost, I want to thank Amanda, Kara, and Chelsea for sharing their stories. It's always difficult to follow those stories like the ones we just heard, but my job today is to explain why we tell stories like theirs and why these narratives matter. Mormons for Agency is a relatively new group. And by relatively, I mean we officially finished our website yesterday. But we want to talk about ideas that have existed in progressive and feminist Mormon conversations for decades. Contrary to many political statements, especially in Utah, and things said over the pulpit and sacrament meeting, Mormonism is a pro-choice, a pro-agency faith. In my opinion, the most important story we tell is the one where we signed up with total affirmative consent to come to Earth, and we continue to choose with God-given agency every single day how we live our lives. However, Utah has some of the most restrictive reproductive rights regulations in the nation. During the last legislative session, there was a fetal anesthesia bill that passed, making it the closest thing to a fetal personhood bill in the United States. The good news is, Mormonism, as a religion, has much more open ideologies than its members who are political representatives do. True to the Faith says that people facing an unintended or dangerous pregnancy who are considering abortion should consult with their local church leaders and see if they receive a confirmation through earnest prayer. And while Mormonism might not be adamantly pro-choice in the political or social sense, we are devoutly pro-agency. We believe in personal revelation and a personal relationship with God that allows us to make our own choices and do what is right for us. It's this reality that has resulted in our new group, Mormons for Agency. As the stories we heard today show, Mormons have abortions. And I'm making an assumption here, so I apologize, but the number of people in this room shows me that there are a good number of Mormons who support a person's right to choose. The goal of Mormons for Agency, then, is to be a resource to Mormons who have had or are considering an abortion, Mormon people who find themselves unintentionally pregnant, and Mormon people to educate themselves on abortion, comprehensive sex ed, and contraceptives within a Mormon paradigm. We want to demonstrate through an online space and a social presence that Mormons who are pro-choice exist and vote and care about these issues. We believe that there should be a Mormon voice in the conversation about reproductive justice, and we are hoping to be that voice. So thank you again for coming today, and we're now going to hear a couple other perspectives on why this issue matters.
Hi, my name is Crystal. I'm really grateful that Emma went before me because following those three emotional stories, I couldn't keep it together. But I want to say I do what I do, and I'm here today because of those women's stories. Sorry, I am Mormon, so I'm a crier. We Mormons are told three things that are a little bit contradictory when it comes to the discussions surrounding reproductive justice. And one of those is that we believe that agency is so important, we fought a war in heaven over it. The second is that we have these religious beliefs of abortion is only morally justified in cases of rape, incest, and extreme endangerment. You know, we all know that list, right? The third is that this Constitution of this United States of America is divine, and that the separation of church and state is something that's doctrinally important. So much so that it's even in the Doctrine and Covenants in section 134 in verse 7, and I'm going to read verse 9, which is, "We do not believe it just to mingle religious influence with civil government whereby one religious society is fostered and another prescribed in its spiritual privileges and the individual rights of its members as citizens denied." And so those are three kind of competing ideas, because if we truly believe that agency is so important, that freedom is so important, why do we so frequently, especially here in Utah, put our religious beliefs into law and into policy and into practice. And long before I ever figured out that I'm a Mormon Democrat, I actually was a Republican who supported choice because I did not see why government should prescribe my religious beliefs over everybody else's. And so the reason we have Mormons for Agency here today, and the reason why I sit on the Planned Parenthood board, and the reason why I fight for this woman's right to have the freedom to make the choice that works for her and her belief system, if she has one, and her situation, is the only thing that is fair is that if abortion remains legal, and if it is easy to have access to, that we don't have all of these exceptions that keep creeping into law where you have to wait so many hours and so many weeks and only certain kinds, and then states where there may be one provider or no provider, as in the case of several southern states. What's the name of that doctrine that we heard from, Kate? Do you remember? Willie Parker, yeah. So, like, I mean, Willie Parker is, like, the only abortion provider in, like, five states, right? I mean, that is not a situation that allows a woman to make the freedom of choice that she needs to make. And so the question that I always ask when I have this conversation, because oddly enough, I actually get asked more how I can be a Mormon Democrat more often than how I can be a Mormon who sits on the Planned Parenthood board. But those questions are connected. And the question I always ask in this country that celebrates diversity, where all are created equal, is it fair for your belief to be the one that makes it into law? And for us Mormons who have arguably a fairly liberal position on abortion compared to many other Christian churches, which I know because I lived in Texas and every day in high school they said, you're a baby killer because you're a Mormon. Crazy, right? But the only thing that, so that question is that fair? Is that fair to put my belief or a Catholic person's belief or a Muslim person's belief or no person's belief above everybody else? And it's not. What is fair is when we have that choice to make the choice that works for us. And these three women who spoke before are all examples of why they needed to be able to have that choice before them today. So thank you so much.
I also can't get up here and not say how powerful those stories were, so thank you so much. It was great. If I can get this on that. And Emma and Crystal, you also touched on this, but before I wanted to talk about the legal landscape of abortion, I wanted to touch on the intersection between the Mormon dialogue and the fact that we live in a country and a state that also regulates something we believe in, or many people here believe in. So with the tenets of personal agency, as well as, you know, a tenet of obedience to leaders, we have people who grow up in Utah or within the Mormon faith know those three things that they can rattle off. But it wasn't until quite late in my life that I realized that not only do you have to come to terms with where you stand within the moral and obedience aspect of the LDS faith position on abortion, but you also have to understand that once a woman says she does overcome these hurdles, she falls into all three of these expressly prescribed categories. She's, you know, incestuously raped and it is endangering her health, which hopefully that doesn't affect anyone. But then she still has to live in a state that allows her to get this abortion that, you know, she talked to with her bishop, and she's gone through all of these hurdles. You know, she got confirmation from God, and she still has to be able to you know, if she's gone through the laws of God, she still has to go through the laws of God in order to get that abortion. So since the since the Roe v. Wade decision, the right to abortion has been, it's judicially interpreted from the Constitution, and it's through the right of privacy, which is just basically riding the coattails of a lot of other rights to privacy against government intrusion. So it's certainly not unique in its interpretation. But before Roe v. Wade's decision, there were many states that allowed abortions in certain circumstances, but most states completely did not allow it, except if it was in the endangerment of the woman's life. So that's Roe v. Wade was in 1973. So any Mormon prior to 1973 could have had, revelation that it was right for them and their family to get an abortion and would not be able to. Would either have to go to an illegal provider or would have that infringement on their power of agency. But the holding of Roe v. Wade was a little messy, and I want to read it because I have respect for the language, but this is just the summary of their exact holdings. So for the stage prior to approximately the end of the first trimester, the abortion decision is left to the medical judgment of the pregnant woman's attending physician. For the stage subsequent to approximately the end of the first trimester, the state, in promoting its interest in the health of the mother, may, if it chooses, regulate the abortion procedure in ways that are reasonably related to maternal health. So the mother is in charge for that very quasi-time, and then the state is in charge after that. And then it says, for the stage subsequent to viability, the state, in promoting its interest in the potentiality of human life, may, if it chooses, in appropriate medical judgment for the preservation of life or the health of its mother, intervene. So, as I'm sure you noticed, that is very difficult language. Prior to approximately the end of the first trimester. And since trimesters are already rough, based on a woman's calculation of her menstrual cycle, it's not, these are clearly not black and white rules, and it was really difficult to apply. And for the next almost 20 years, a lot of cases would come up, percolate through the appellate system, and the justices refused to take the case, a lot of them because conservatives wanted to make sure that we could have a good case, that it would Roe v. Wade could be overturned. And then more liberal justices, or justices that were on the majority for Roe, didn't want to risk that. And so it wasn't until 1992 in Planned Parenthood versus Casey that they took on the idea of abortion again. So in those nearly 20 years, there were many laws that were enacted in states that it wasn't clear whether they were constitutional or not. So they were enacted, and since it wasn't clear or it wasn't easily taken to court, then a lot of people were denied access to abortions because it was just lack of clarity. And so in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, they did a slightly cleaner standard. It's now an undue burden test, and there's viability over trimester framework. So there's still a lot of gray area as to what undue burden means, especially after Casey. And in the meantime, there have been a lot of laws enacted still to try to make it as difficult as possible for women to enforce her right. And so in Utah, for example, some of the laws that we had, there was actually a Utah case that was decided as the Casey case was pending, and so we have exactly what it was. And it was after 90 days from her last period, the court or the Utah legislature said that it had to be in a hospital. And so that's not just, you think about inconveniences in changing a location, that's not the big thing. It's the big thing of the expense. So if women are getting pregnant because they can't afford birth control, they can't afford condoms even, it's going to be very unlikely that they're going to be able to afford a stay in the hospital. And then they could have the abortion after 20 weeks if the physician deemed it necessary to save a woman's life or prevent grave damage to her health, or the child was born with defects so severe it was very unlikely they would survive. And then before 20 weeks, it was the result of rape that had to be reported to the police very close to the incident. And then incest must be reported to the police. So those are very similar to the LDS position. But they also had a law requiring notification to someone's spouse or partner before termination. So, and considering the fact that if you're in a relationship and you're not able to communicate or you don't feel safe to communicate the fact that you're pregnant or that you're getting an abortion, that's probably the worst thing you can do is to mandate that that person then notifies that spouse. And so, and the statistics of violence within intimate spouses is the average is that 3 women die each day because of domestic violence. So that's not unfeasible to think that it affected a lot of women and their safety in Utah. So then after Planned Parenthood, the undue burden test has also been similarly difficult to apply. And just recently this year, Whole Woman's Health, we used to be Whole Woman's Health v. Cole, and now it's Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt, was decided, and it was found that it just clarified the undue burden test a little more and just tightened up whether it, so now the court will look to whether the medical necessity or benefit that the state wants to impose on a woman by its regulations, that has to outweigh the undue burden that it's going to put onto the woman trying to get an abortion. And so that is likely going to make it easier to find a lot of these trap laws. Trap laws are targeted regulations against abortion providers. That'll likely make it easier to bring these laws to court. But you have to remember that when the court decides something, it doesn't automatically strike laws that are unconstitutional. You have to find a person that is so perfectly situated as to be able to bring the case. That person has to have resources to bring the case. That case has to go through all these levels. Likely, if it's a state judge, they're likely going to be more, they could be more deferential to a state regulation. So it still doesn't make it, this Supreme Court decision doesn't make it easy uniformly for everyone to get an abortion. It's still going to be very difficult, and women who have the right to choose under God might not have that under their legislature. So, thanks.
Okay, so I am actually about to start a program in public health, so I'm really excited that I get to talk about this today, and I feel very privileged to be in this place. So I want to start by reading some global data, and then I'm going to move into data that's more specific to and closer to me. Every day in 2015, 830 women died due to complications of pregnancy and childbirth. So that adds up to over 300,000 women worldwide. Women, only about 73% of women have access to skilled care during the process of pregnancy. And about 76% of women of reproductive age have access to contraception. It's 43.6%. Contraceptives are used by the majority of married or in union women almost in all regions of the world. However, it is clearly a place where we are lacking. In fact, currently abortion is very limited. And it says that there's 97 countries where you can have an abortion to save a woman's life. Now, we need to remember that these are very... the fact that it's legal does not mean that it's accessible, because it may be legal, for example, to go get an abortion, but you have to consider social and economic factors. So, meaning, Do you live in a rural setting? Do you have access to a hospital or a clinic? Additionally, will your family face scorn or, you know, any type of shaming, public shaming because of your decision? Or is your family supportive of you? Additionally, there are many countries where it might be required to have support of a partner or of parents, etc. So just because it says 97 countries that allow for abortion to save a woman's 97% of countries allows for abortions to save the lives of women. There are definitely many lives of many women that are lost because women do not have access to this. Then there are 67% of countries allow for an abortion to preserve physical health, 63% in order to preserve mental health, and then 49% in case of rape or incest. Additionally, 47% allow in case of fetal impairment, and 34% for social economic reasons, or 29% on request. So there are very limited, you know, circumstances in which women can have access to abortion. And it's very difficult because throughout the process of pregnancy, women do not have access to proper health care. And so there is no way to really determine what it is that is happening with the fetus and with the health of the woman. And it is therefore very difficult to measure exactly what the numbers are and what the percentage of women affected is. Now, it depends on every country because every country is so different, but I want to go specifically to one country that is very dear to me, and that's Guatemala, because that's where I'm from. And so Guatemala published a report, and I want to give some background before I move into more specifics. So reproductive health is a state of physical, mental, and social well-being, and not just the absence of mere illness. And in consequence, reproductive health encompasses the capacity to enjoying a satisfying sexual life without risks, and to be able to procreate and to have the liberty to decide to do it or not to do it, when to do it, and how frequently to do it. So that's what reproductive health means. Additionally, Rosalind Pachetsky sustains that the reproductive rights can be defined in terms of power and resources, meaning power to make decisions that are informed in respect to family, to your own family, to the upbringing, education of your children, to your reproductive health and your sexual activity, and then have the resources to take these decisions into practice in a safe and effective manner. So that's what we're referring to when we talk about reproductive health. Additionally, these are this is a list of some of the reproductive rights that are being fought for, including the right for women to control and decide over their own bodies, the right to receive healthcare services that are of high quality, where there is no discrimination in relationship to the age, sex, sexual orientation, or whether or not you're single or married. Additionally, the right to decide whether or not to have children and the time that's lapsed between pregnancies. The right to receive information about methods of family planning and to have actual access to them and be able to choose freely without being coerced into one or the other. There's also the right to enjoy sexuality without having the need to procreate. The right to have a free choice about regarding sexual practices, the right to live a life full and free of sexual violence, and to decide whether to have sexual relations or not with your partner or with other people, the right to sexual privacy, the right to equal sexual activity, the right to equal expression in regards to sexual orientation, as well as the different distinctions between your gender identity. There's also the right to receive information and education in regards to sexuality. And again, this is independent of sexual orientation or race or gender identity. And also the right to sexual pleasure, the right to attention to sexual health, and the right to have information and attention in the case of sexual activity and in the case of sexual illness. So this is kind of a list of all the rights that are being fought for. Again, not many of these are recognized. And so, for example, when I say the right to sexual pleasure, we think, well, that sounds, you know, that sounds really entitled. you know? And we say, well, where do I get that right? But this is very important because this is a change in the framework and in the way that we think about sex and in the way that we think, especially in different societies and cultures, in the way that sex is perceived. The country, I'm going to speak only of my country because it's the country I can speak for, and these are the circumstances that I can speak about. So, for example, in Guatemala, there's a prevalent culture of machismo, in which the woman is perceived as an object to be kept at home and to be kept cooking and be kept, you know, procreating and be kept pleasuring the husband. And there is little to no information or education in regards to the anatomy, in regards to the vagina or the vulva, or in regards to the pleasure and how to make this happen. And so women are perceived as either, you know, like very pure, they do not experience, you know, sexual arousal or sexual desire, and it's only the husband who is, you know, exuberant and exuding sexual, you know, sexual energy that must come home and, you know, provide that and be able to have children that way. And so the right to sexual pleasure, you know, it is this right to know and understand your body and understand how it works and understand what your body, what you like sexually, what you don't like sexually, and be able to do what you like and not do what you don't like. And so this is, again, a changing framework, and all these rights are being fought by different organizations in Guatemala. And they're being either, you know, legislated in one way or another, either educationally or in, you know, or in different aspects of Guatemalan society. Now, this is important because Guatemala has very, you know, dire and very terrible, you know, circumstances. There is about 153 deaths for every 100,000 births. This is death of the mother. So it's alarmingly high. And sadly, because of recent corruption scandals and recent recent problems in the health system in Guatemala, this number has been going up. And during pregnancy, only 60% of women receives attention. During the entire process of pregnancy, only 60% receive attention. And when it comes to pregnancy, at the age of 15, 6.1% of young women have been pregnant, and 2.6% are mothers. Additionally, at the age of 18, 29.6% of adolescent women have been pregnant, and 24% are mothers. This is one-fourth of all women. Additionally, only 7.5% of adolescent women between the ages of 15 and 19 have used a contraceptive method, and 68.9% of adolescent women know no contraceptive methods. So again, these are very difficult numbers to process. And we also need to consider that in Guatemala, there are racial constructs that are very different from the United States. So while I am Latino here in the United States, that's not what I am in Guatemala. In Guatemala, I'm Ladino with a D, not a T, which is a distinction from, you know, un indígena, which is like the indigenous population in Guatemala. And so the average of children per mother in indigenous communities is 6.1 versus in, you know, Ladino communities, which is like 2.4. So there are radical and stark differences depending on what racial construct is built around you and how you have access to these, because additionally, indigenous communities tend to be rural communities that have no access to healthcare. So now, this is all very, you know, very heavy, and these are problems that are being, you know, tackled on by many feminists and many, you know, thinkers in Guatemala that I've been following. And in fact, we just got a new minister of health who is the daughter of an activist from the 80s. So we have a woman leading all health efforts in Guatemala. So I'm really proud of that. That's one good thing. Now, there are many arguments that can be made to change these numbers. And so, for example, back in the 80s, 90s, we had these arguments of you know, economic growth. And so we have capitalistic arguments that are made. For example, we can say, well, you know, there is a correlation between the GDP of a country and how many, you know, how easy access is to, you know, reproductive rights and reproductive justice. Additionally, women who have access to these rights are able to make more decisions and are able to, for example, be in the workforce and be productive. And they're, and again, I'm saying that these arguments are capitalistic arguments. or women are able to learn how to read or write or have a profession when they're able to access these. But, however, our arguments need to go beyond that, because these are arguments that are focused on the capacity of capitalistic production by women. And as people who come from a Mormon background, we cannot allow our arguments to be that shallow, because this is not an argument about, production, but it's an argument about personhood and about the right to be who you are and the right to make decisions for yourself regardless of what you're producing for someone else. And so when we come to analyze all the different laws regarding abortion throughout the world, we find that religion is closely associated with restrictions on abortion and reproductive justice and rights. And in the most oppressive countries, in fact, are in Latin America, and they're not in the Middle East, that have completely banned abortion, for example, Chile and Nicaragua and La República Dominicana, I believe. Interestingly enough, the Vatican and Malta. So again, there's a heavy influence that we have from religion that is shaping the way that laws are made. And so this calls for us to rethink our theology and rethink the application of our theology in order to defend these rights. And so it's not just, again, like it's been said before, not just saying, we need to give these rights, because it's okay. It's true. There are many arguments to be made about it. However, it is when we look into the holiest, what we deem the holiest, meaning our theology, that we can touch, the hearts of many and talk about how, our theology does allow for this. And so, again, like it's been mentioned, we have been fighting for agency for a long time. And before we came to this earth, Mormonism states that we fought this battle. And so this is something that needs to, keep happening. Additionally, we have been called stewards over our own bodies. And so in order to have the freedom to make those choices, we need to have access to the information as to how our bodies work, what our bodies do, and how to best take care of our bodies. Again, this is something that is, that I've heard mentioned every once in a while, that, in some sacrament meeting, someone says sex is good, and then everyone wakes up. And then we realize, that Mormonism does teach that sex is good. And so we need to remember that, and remember that we have that right to pleasure, and that we have that right to have dominion over our bodies and know how they work and what our bodies like in order to be able to, have that justice and those rights given to us. And then another thing that we need to consider as part of our, this framework of Mormonism is the capability that the Mormon Church as an organization has throughout the world. So in 2013, I believe, or actually 2003, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints partnered with the Ministry of Health in Guatemala for a vaccination program that worked really well and helped give the MMR vaccine to children all over Guatemala and helped eliminate, actually, measles and mumps, I believe. And so it was a really, really strong effort. So if we can use the infrastructure that we have in reaching out to all those women in rural places and all those people who need access to reproductive health care, we can have that power to have a really, really strong impact like the one that this campaign had in Guatemala in 2003. I guess thinking about all these numbers and thinking about all this infrastructure and the way that our theology allows for that, I have started to really see this not just as something that we can do, but something that we must do. Because if we are going to be defenders of agency, we need to defend every single choice. And when a woman dies because she has no access, she has no longer the ability to make any choice whatsoever. And so this is of utmost importance that we are defending not just this one choice, but every single choice that will come after that. And even if the result of the lack of care is not death, there can be severe consequences into the life of women into the life of their families and into the life, and especially, again, in rural places, the least among us, that can be very lasting and that can impact every single choice that is being made. So I hope that when we think about Mormons for Agency and we look, you know, of course, at the decision to have an abortion, we realize that this is a decision, this is an effort not just for that one choice, but for every single choice that will come in life after that, because that is the true empowerment that will come as we make those, you know, those decisions that we know best and that women know best when they decide for themselves, you know, and to the goddess that they may or may not believe in. And the last thing I want to point out is that in addition to helping women, access to abortion and reproductive rights also has a great effect for LGBTQ minorities, especially transgender men. Transgender men are men who have vaginas and vulvas, and so these men also need health care for their vaginas and their vulvas because they can be pregnant. And so because the recent hormonal treatments and hormonal therapies that transgender men go under, there hasn't been much research regarding that. They need constant healthcare to make sure that their bodies are functioning well and that they can be perfectly healthy. At the same time, lesbians also tend to have higher rates of, for example, breast cancer and other types of cancer. And so it's very important that that all of these rights and all of these services regarding healthcare be accessible, not just for cisgender straight women, but for every single person so that we can all enjoy full usage and, you know, full pleasure of our bodies. Thank you.
We have one more presenter, but I just wanted to remind you that our question and answer is going to be done via the note cards. So if you have anything, please start thinking about that and I'll come around.
The pregnancy experiences of Cara, Amanda, and Chelsea are sacred, and they're also authoritative. And I want to honor the sacred space created by them sharing that. I was asked to share some historical perspective on LDS policy on birth control and abortion, and some historical perspective on feminist responses to that. It's a huge topic, so I'm going to try to talk fast. In 1999, I wrote, I gave a Sunstone paper called Multiply and Replenish If You Want To. And I published part of that paper in this article in a local paper to try to get some important news, historic news out, because that year, 98, the most lenient and agency-affirming policy on birth control in LDS history was made, and I'll get into that in a second. But in my paper and in this article, I review some of the highs and lows in the historical arc over 100 years from 1900 to 2000, and the policy changes, how they evolved and actually reversed from denouncement to approval of birth control. So first I'm going to talk about the historical perspective on birth control, and then I'll talk about some perspective on abortion. In this article, I hit some highlights. I mentioned that in the 1800s, birth control was rare and primitive, and LDS leaders rejected all forms of it. But in 1908, Joseph F. Smith created the first statement on birth control, likely in response to emerging women's concerns about women's health and birth control at that time in the secular culture. He warned members not to prevent spirits from obtaining earthly tabernacles, and he said, "I do not hesitate to say that prevention is wrong." In 1914, there was a consideration allowed for the health of the parents, not necessarily the woman, but the parents. In 1942, there was consideration of some financial well-being. And in the 1940s to the 1960s, leaders came out with a variety of different and contradictory views on birth control. Some allowed rhythm method, some rejected it, some condoned proper spacing of children, others saw birth control as gross wickedness. J. Reuben Clark saw it as a personal decision and said the church had no official position, while Heber J. Grant advocated it pregnancy as a duty and responsibility of parenthood that should not be prevented. Elder Widso favored the rhythm method and said the church had no position, while David O. McKay considered the health of the mother and proper spacing of children to be an important consideration. In 1960, Hugh B. Brown said that the LDS believe in large families wherever possible. In 1969, the first formal church statement, other than just a church leader or church president statement, but the first formal church statement about birth control came out, likely in reaction to the pill. Again, a reaction to secular advances in women's birth control and health care. That statement said, "It is contrary to the teaching of the church to artificially curtail or prevent the birth of children. However, we feel that men must be considerate of their wives." Nice of them, wasn't it? In the 1970s and 80s, Presidents Kimball and Elders Kimball and Benson renewed the admonition to have as many children as possible. Many of us remember those admonitions from the 70s and 80s because we lived through them as fertile women. In 1979, the Church Handbook of Instruction, the policy was basically the same, with the same admonitions going clear back to 1914, that women and parents have a spiritual obligation to bear children and have a family. However, there was one consideration allowed. It allowed that the health of the mother and the well-being of the family should be considered. So, a little progress there. In 1989, there was a real shift in allowing a little bit more consideration. Church policy was still admonishing parenthood, but allowed for more personal agency. The couples are counseled to avoid selfishness. However, the number of children they have is entirely a personal decision. This signaled a shift, an important historic shift. Yet it wasn't the most lenient and affirming policy to come, which came 10 years later. In 1998, the Church Handbook of Instructions included a policy that was the most historic, and it was the most lenient policy in church history. All of the admonitions and commandments and responsibilities to bear children were gone. Only personal agency and responsibility remained, and it left all decisions entirely up to the parents. The policy read, "The decision as to how many children to have and when to have them is extremely intimate and private and should be left between the couple and the Lord. Church members should not judge one another in this matter." This was fascinating because it implied that agency took precedence over church advice, doctrine, or policy. Also, this new policy in 1998 was mild compared to the proclamation on the family 3 years before it. The proclamation affirmed that we declare that God's commandment for his children to multiply and replenish the earth remains in force. Interestingly, the Church Handbook of Instruction supposedly is more binding on members than a proclamation. Interestingly, in 1998 and 99, none of us Mormon women knew about this new policy in the Church Handbook of Instructions, which often happens, as we know, unless somebody leaks it to the internet, which we didn't have back then. So we were really in the dark without the internet. Fortunately, the Associated Press broke the story, and then I presented at Sunstone, and I wrote this article in a local tabloid just to get the news out to Mormon women so they would know that there was a new policy governing their bodies. I also began working on a book, which I didn't finish, but I interviewed Mormon women across the spectrum, from conservative to liberal and non-feminist to feminist, to find out if they used birth control, if they didn't use it, or if they wished they'd used it. What I found was that every woman I interviewed, except one, had felt constrained and coerced into pregnancy and bearing more children than they wanted. Only one woman that I interviewed felt that she'd had the children that she'd wanted to have. But all of them said the new policy in 1998 was completely different from everything they'd been taught all their lives. This left some of them feeling both glad but very bitter that the policy had changed. Today, in 2010, the policy is the same. It has not changed since the 1998 policy. It reads exactly the same, word for word, in today's handbook. This begs a question and brings up the issue of church policy versus church doctrine, because the doctrine to multiply and replenish the earth remains in force, but the policy has changed from denouncement to permission. And from control of women's bodies to freedom and agency. This is interesting because, again, It begs the question, how binding is policy and how binding should it be? Can members just simply ignore policy then if it's going to change, especially over time, and if different leaders are going to stipulate different policies? It really does come down to, in the tension between doctrine and policy, it really does come down to the notion of doctrinally multiply and replenish, but policy-wise, if you want to. Interestingly, historically, Mormon family size has not conformed to the large, unlimited family ideal. In 1910, the average Mormon family had 4 to 5 children. In the 1960s, the average Mormon family had less than 4 children. Mormons used birth control regardless of church policy all those years. At least some of them did. Many women still felt constrained. Since 1935, surveys show that the majority of Mormons supported or used a birth control. And since 1975, 96% have been using birth control. Now to consider abortion, I want to review some policy and also some feminist response. As with birth control, male church leaders' views and interpretations of doctrine have differed widely from each other, at least in regards to whether the fetus is an eternal soul. Male church leader views on when the spirit enters the body, the baby's body in utero, have varied greatly across the spectrum, ranging from the spirit enters the body at the moment of conception all the way to the spirit enters the body just before birth. So there's no consensus. This begs the question, which leader's view or statement is the correct one? Which one represents the view of God? Should they all be viewed as human advice instead? However, church policy, unlike church leaders' personal statements, shows far less change regarding abortion than it does regarding birth control. Church policy on abortion has been and remains consistently very strict. Abortion is a sin to be avoided unless the mother's life is in danger, with very few exceptions. The 2010, the most recent Church Handbook of Instructions, stipulates that members must not submit to, perform, arrange for, pay for, consent to, or encourage an abortion. The only possible exceptions are when pregnancy results from forcible rape or incest, when the life or health of the mother is in serious jeopardy, if the fetus has severe defects that will not allow the baby to survive beyond birth. Abortion is a serious matter, and only after persons have consulted with their bishops and received divine confirmation through prayer should they make a decision, and they may be subject to church discipline. These are some highlights from the current church policy. Interestingly, in 1998, the church policy had one paragraph in the 1998 Church Handbook of Instructions that is gone now, which is quite interesting. It said, the church has not favored or opposed legislative proposals or public demonstrations concerning abortion. However, the First Presidency encourages members as citizens to let their voices be heard in appropriate and legal ways that will evidence their belief in the sacredness of life. This was taken from a statement in the Ensign in March 1991. And I can assure you that back in 1990 and 91, church members did voice their views. At that time, in between 1990 and 1993, was one of the most conflicted, tumultuous times in local culture regarding abortion. The Utah legislature, which was 94% male and 90% Mormon, attempted for 3 or 4 years in a row to pass the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation with strict limits and required permissions. Utah also led the nation in an effort to overturn Roe v. Wade for the first time since it was passed in 1973. Fortunately, the Supreme Court refused to pass Utah's attempt to overturn Roe v. Wade. So at that time, Mormons and feminists from across the spectrum on both sides of the issue, engaged in a historic wave of public voice and public activism. I want to cite or quote from a few examples of this activism, the feminist response, which I was part of, and sort of some of the things that we did. There were articles in Exponent 2 in 1989 and 1990 where women were sharing their personal stories, and Mormon women were insisting that it was okay to have an abortion. One woman said, yes, the official church position is against abortion, but according to our doctrine, abortion does not kill the spirit. What it means is that the spirit is forced to go elsewhere. And so with a prayerful heart, as a family, we made a decision that the best interest of this particular spirit was to deny its birth at this time in our family. There were many other stories that I don't have time to share, but I'll move on. There were panels and debates at Sunstone, at the Salt Lake Library, and at the U of U with pro-choice and pro-pregnancy advocates who were LDS and non-LDS on both sides. Richard Wilkins, Marianne Wood, and Camille Williams from BYU were advocating to protect all life after conception, while Planned Parenthood, the Women's Health Center, Carrie Galloway, and Kurt Lee Jones, a doctor at the U of U, were advocating a woman's right to choice. Kurt Lee Jones said at that time, a woman is not an incubator, she's a person. There was also a Utah pro-choice coalition that we formed with Mormon and non-LDS women. We lobbied the Utah legislature every session. We lobbied every legislator. We did everything we could. We held actions and protests at the Capitol and rallies at the Capitol to keep abortion safe and legal. Cecilia Farr, a BYU professor, was there. In fact, that's where Cecilia and I met, was at one of the abortion rallies. And this caused her problems for her status at BYU. In one of our actions at the Capitol, we wore black clothes and we had big chains that we wrapped around our bodies to signify that we were chained. In another one, we wore long black skirts and blouses and black scarves over our heads to sort of simulate a burqa, to say that we were faceless and voiceless if the legislators were going to legislate a control of our body. The Mormon Women's Forum, which I co-edited, did a special issue focused, devoted to abortion, as Exponent 2 also had. So all of this is happening between 1990 and 93. There's a lot going on. Four of us wrote articles. Michelle Wynn, a local attorney, and there were four Mormon feminist articles taking positions across on different sides. Michelle Wynn, an attorney, argued that abortion should not be criminalized. This imposes one person's religious beliefs onto others. And abortion rights should not be decided by the rule of men. It's an issue of female health. Camille Williams, a BYU professor, argued a feminist anti-abortion view. She said, we don't have to choose between having children and career, and we shouldn't punish women for being pregnant. They deserve more support. We should respect the strength and the ability of women to bear children, and we should not be pitting women against their own bodies. Abortion pits women against their own bodies. Instead, we should solve the problems that put them in that situation. In this way, Camille offered a middle ground for both sides, that we need better birth control so that women are not pitted against their own bodies. I argued that against what I called compulsory pregnancy, which compels women to bear offspring against their own will. And I argued that there is no such thing as a risk-free pregnancy. Every pregnancy can risk the health and life of the mother. After the 1990s, the Utah legislative battles died down and settled into semi-restrictive laws. The Utah legislature has not launched a big fight over abortion since the 90s until this year. This year has felt a bit like a flashback to the 90s. Governor Herbert announced that I have a problem with Roe v. Wade, but it is the law of the land. And legislator Kurt Oda had sponsored House Bill 442 to try to make illegal some abortion procedures, with some exceptions for emergency situations to save the woman. Thank heavens. What's interesting is that there have been no other states proposing similar strict laws to the ones that were attempting to be passed this season. Meanwhile, Utah's abortion rate has only dropped over the years. At the last report in 2014, it was the lowest ever. There are only 4 abortions per 1,000 women per year. Thanks.
I'll go ahead and read these comments and questions. If you guys want to respond, just speak closely into those microphones so that the responses are recorded. Our first one, and I just kind of shuffled these, so I hope we get to all of them, but they're in no particular order. No one has mentioned emergency contraception, after the fact, over the counter, morning after pill. Is this part of the discussion in the church? Or, I guess, Mormons for agency? There.
Oh, good. So in the process of finishing the website yesterday afternoon, I spent most of the day reading every single link that you find when you go to LDS.org and search abortion, birth control, and sex ed. So I read some real fun things. But one of the interesting things I found is that there are almost no mentions of emergency contraception. And I'm assuming that's not because the brethren don't know they exist. It's maybe a possibility. But... But I think that possibly purposefully that's been left out of the conversation, since for a lot of people, emergency contraceptives are in a gray area between abortion and contraceptives. And while Mormons are pro-contraceptives, we allow them and in some cases seem to encourage them, we are generally anti-abortion. But I think that's been left out of most of these conversations. However, I think it's an important part of what Mormons for Agency should be talking about.
Thank you. I think this is a really important question. Will Mormons for Agency also work on access to infertility treatment? It is an important and often overlooked aspect of reproductive rights. Anyone?
Hi, I'll talk more. Okay, this microphone's really weird. We have not talked about infertility treatment, but one thing I can say is that that is a part of what Planned Parenthood does, and Mormons for Agency does stand in alliance with Planned Parenthood. A lot of us have been involved with Planned Parenthood, and I can speak for myself, and I'm assuming I can speak for this board, that we all agree that infertility treatments are so important and should be a part of what we're talking about whenever we talk about women's health.
Yes, thank you for that comment. It's really important. You're correct. It is very often overlooked when we talk about reproductive rights. This is a comment. It says, I went to Planned Parenthood for the first time just this last year. As we know, not all forms of birth control are absolutely 100% effective 100% of the time. I had an IUD, which is normally considered 100% effective, nearly, but it dislodged and I was unaware and had unknowingly unprotected sex with my partner. Thank goodness for Planned Parenthood and Plan B. Thank you. Thank you for that comment. We really appreciate the personal stories that make this so real. This comment, I have 13 and 11-year-old children, and I want to take control of their sex education. What resources do you have for me to teach sex ed, i.e. what to teach and what age to teach them?
I'll jump in on that.
Yeah, go for it.
Planned Parenthood has a teen council that has put amazing amounts of research and time, and it's medically accurate, and it's wonderful, and it's a fantastic resource for any teenagers, any parents of teenagers, any parents of small children. It's a great resource.
Great. I would say my children are not quite that old. My oldest is 8, but I really like the book Sex is a Funny Word. It is a really great introduction to sex ed and a very non-binary and inclusive language and illustrations. And that has been a really easy way to bring up the topic and discuss it with my children. So I really like that resource. Well, I don't know if we have enough time for this one, but are you ready? How can we break the stigma around sex and sexual health within Mormonism? Thoughts? Ideas?
Can we have another panel?
You have 7 minutes.
Well, I mean, I do think it's important for us to say, like, what Mormons for Agency is and what we're not. Because, you know, there are so many issues around sexuality and sex and reproductive health and reproductive rights. And we're a new organization with a newly minted website. And we can't do it all, you know. Well, I mean, and what we're trying to do right now is to form positive conversations in this Mormon world around agency and choice and reproductive rights, and that's really where we're focused right now. But will we get there eventually? Maybe.
Yeah. Thank you,
Sammy. But it's definitely a big part of it.
Sammy, you've been talking about what's going on in Guatemala and in the how are they addressing those? You look so excited to answer this.
I think we're just around the same. So again, it's about what we do and what we're not. Right now, we have a very like U.S. centric campaign because we're Mormons. So. But I'm interested to see in the future if we'll delve into other languages and other cultures.
I was just going to add that as a very parental, pregnancy, family, you know, focused church that celebrates bodies and sexuality, it's interesting that the Church Handbook of Instructions from 1998 to the present one reminds us that married couples should also understand that sexual relations within marriage are divinely approved. And not only for the purpose of procreation, but also as a way of expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds between husband and wife. So there's a sex-affirming statement in the handbook.
Thank you.
If you want one.
If you want one. If I could read the handbook, I would. I can't. Okay, and our last one. It says, I am persuaded by much of the pro-choice slash agency argument. I am wondering if someone can speak to any rights a fetus may have. I find it absent from the discussion of the pro-choice side. We require people to care for pets and children who cannot advocate for themselves. What responsibility do we have to the unborn?
It's important to talk about the rights of fetuses in conjunction, and that's what we talked about a little bit with the constitutional analysis, but in conjunction with the rights of the mother. So anytime you give a right to someone or something, you're taking it away from someone or something. I think it was Dworkin, Professor Dworkin, who gave the analysis that he said, if we gave trees the rights to live, then we would probably criminalize the publication of books, which would infringe on our First Amendment right to communicate ideas. So by giving fetuses, you know, this much more right, you have to take that away from the person. So while they're definitely, fetus rights are definitely within the discussion, but it's just balancing how much should the fetus have control over the mother's life. I don't know if that helped.
Right. Well, I think with that, we can say thank you to the presenters and to the audience and for Mormons for Agency for talking about this.
As one more fun interruption, most of you should have a business card on your seat. It has all our social media. You should also check out our website, which is mormonsforagency.org. It's brand new. It's shiny. It's great. But yeah, and we're on most forms of social media that millennials use, so...